We started studying about the qualifications of elders in God's church last week as part of the overall study on the eldership that we've been engaged in now for several weeks. And we've been reserving Sunday nights for this study. Sunday nights do give us a little bit more time for study than typically Sunday mornings. We have a little bit more time for the Sunday evening lessons. And also this subject matter, those of us that are here tonight, and by the way, our attendance has been very consistent Sunday mornings, Sunday nights, and Wednesday nights. That's been a very good thing that we want to see continue. So we don't, in a lot of places, there's a very big difference between in the attendance on Sunday mornings and Sunday nights. And it shouldn't be that way. We should all, unless there's something physically or otherwise hindering us from being here, we want to be here anytime the church is assembling. That's the way the Lord wants it to be, and just about everybody has been doing their best to do that, and so that's excellent. So it's not like we tend to have a Sunday morning crowd and a Sunday night crowd like occurs in a lot of places. So we want to keep that up, but still we've been trying to use some of our Sunday night study time here for this subject of looking at the Lord's teachings about the eldership and the elders in God's church, and we've looked at various aspects of that is taught in God's Word, and now we've started focusing in on the qualifications of the elders. And y'all did something last week that I had meant to encourage you to do, and so you didn't require the encouragement to do it anyway, but if there's anything that doesn't come out, or there's something you're not satisfied about as far as maybe a question in your mind on any of these qualifications or any other part of this study, I'm not going to be able to anticipate everything, and I'm a human being too, so I might forget something or leave something out that we should cover. But if there's something that doesn't get covered like you want it to, or you feel like you have some question that maybe didn't get addressed, let me know, because we'll try to squeeze it in. And even if we have to go back a little bit, we'll be glad to do that. So several of you got to me last Sunday evening after we finished because I made what was probably a mistake trying to cover that last qualification of our study last week, the husband of one wife. And I really was trying to focus in on part of that, the part that lets us know that indeed the elders in the church have to be men, and they have to be married men. There are some other aspects of that qualification, being the husband of one wife, and several of you got right to it and had some good questions about that, which we want to deal with here at the outset of our study this evening. And I really appreciate y'all doing that. So if there are on any of these other ones, if there are any questions you have, or if there's something that maybe isn't quite clear, then surely I would appreciate you to let me know so we can try to cover all this. As much as possible, we want all of this to be taught in a way that we really do understand what the qualifications are and their purpose. One of the things that we were trying to accomplish in looking at that particular qualification, being the husband of one wife, I mean, clearly the Lord intends for the ones who hold the office of an elder are there to be men, and they are to be married men. And there is a good reason for that. And we mentioned part of why that would make sense in terms of God's wisdom to have those that are leading the flock to have a wife. Now, part of it, which we want to study as a separate lesson soon, perhaps next time, but part of that is going to have to do with looking at the man's family as the proving ground for his qualifications of being an elder. And that's a big part of that. So they have to have a wife, and they have to have children as a means of examining the man to see whether his work in his family as leader of his family, because that's going to be a preview that's going to let the everybody know to a very large extent the kind of work he's going to be doing as an elder over God's family. So that's one reason that the Lord gives that qualification. But there are also some practical reasons why that makes sense, not just that the man has been married at some point, but that he still has a wife because There are going to be situations that an elder has to deal with that at certain times it's going to be very helpful for him to have his wife around in dealing with certain situations. So there's some prudent reasons for that qualification. But as far as the qualification of itself, the man being the husband of one wife, a question that several of you brought up is, well, what about if he's been married before and now for some reason he's married again? And a couple of cases, if his first wife died, for example, and if he has remarried, is he still meeting the qualification of the husband of one wife? Now, it's true, there are, we'll find certain brethren in certain places that feel like this is stating that he is to only have been the husband of one wife ever in his life. Now, it doesn't actually, the tense that's used here in the grammar is not saying ever having been. It's talking about presently the husband of one wife. Now, that does, of course, eliminate certain things. I mean, he can't be married to somebody he shouldn't be married to, which would include having another spouse in addition to the one, because then he wouldn't be the husband of one wife. But what about this a situation like that where somebody may have been married before, but they have remarried? Are they still the husband of one wife? Now, when we look at the Lord's teachings about widowhood, whether it's a woman who's a widow or a man who is a widower, in Romans chapter 7, verses 1 through 3, the Lord speaks about the law of the husband and wife. It says, "Know you not, brethren, for I speak to them that know the law, how that the law hath dominion over a man as long as he liveth. For the woman which hath a husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. So then if while her husband liveth, she be married to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man." Now, of course, the same rule applies, whether that's talking about a man or a woman that has been married and their spouse dies. In God's sight, for them to marry again, would that constitute adultery? Are they a bigamist or a polygamist if they have married somebody else after their first spouse has died? And no, he says that law now that bound them as husband and wife, that's now broken because the spouse has died. So though he or she is married to another, that's not a situation where it is adultery. Now, one thing that the Lord does say about this further in 1 Corinthians 7 in verse 39, where he says the wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth, but if her husband be dead, she is at liberty to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. Now there he's making clear something that would apply to a second marriage, that should apply to the first one also. For a Christian, is there any circumstance in which it is a good thing to marry somebody who's not a member of the Lord's body? And that wouldn't be a good thing to do at any time. But here he really focuses in on that in that verse, talking about somebody who is a Christian who is remarrying because they have lost their first spouse due to death. But he says they're at liberty to marry whom they will, only in the Lord. Now, as far as a man who serves as an elder in God's church, if he's been married before and his wife has passed away and he remarries in the Lord, and that also lets us know that a marriage is, in God's sight, proper or legitimate if both spouses meet qualifications as in being eligible to be married. That kind of goes along with the only in the Lord. What are we talking about there? Well, this also brings up another issue. What about that of divorce? And in terms of what the New Testament teaches, how many circumstances are there in which, in God's sight, it is... Now, we're not talking about the law of our state or of our land. There we have you can get divorced for any number of reasons and marry somebody else and be legal as far as the law is concerned. But what about in God's sight? How many reasons are there taught in God's word where it is acceptable for somebody to divorce their mate and then to remarry with God's approval? Well, that's found in Matthew 19:9. The answer is one. He says, "And I say to you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery." So what about the guy that cites irreconcilable differences as a reason for putting away? And that's one of the catch-all phrases you see nowadays where people will divorce their spouse. They do that because of irreconcilable differences. Now what about the vow that says you're going to, through richer, poor, better, for worse, that you're going to be with this person till death do you part? For better, for worse. Doesn't that include differences? And you got to find a way to make it work. You got to find a way to reconcile those differences. But anyway, people will divorce somebody because of irreconcilable differences, and that can include anything from burning the toast too much or whatever else you want to throw in there. But is it okay in God's sight for people to put away their spouse for those reasons and then marry somebody else? Does he say that's all right to do? Or what does he say that is? If you put away your wife for, and that would be the same if a woman puts away her husband for any of those other reasons, and then they marry again, what does he say that is? He calls that adultery. Because in God's sight, as he says, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. That's verse 6. So here God is the one that has joined them as husband and wife, and in his sight, just because man is trying to put that asunder doesn't mean God is recognizing that marriage as being legitimately dissolved. And so the one who then marries somebody else, God says that's adultery. They've married a second person without having right to divorce the first one. And so they are in adultery in that situation. There's only one exception that he mentions there, except it be for fornication. That's it. And if anybody divorces for any other reason and marries another, he says it's adultery. And if you marry somebody who's been divorced, and notice he doesn't say except it be, there are no exceptions to that, because if they've been married, if they've been divorced because of their guilty fornication, are they eligible to be remarried? Not according to that. He says then it's adultery. What if they've been divorced for some lesser reason? Well, then again, the Lord doesn't recognize that. That's man putting asunder where they shouldn't. So when the man is putting away his wife for no real reason, he can't marry somebody else, but then nobody should marry her either. And that's what Christ's teaching is there. They're the one that asked the question in verse 3, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? What's his answer? The answer is no. There's only one cause. And even then we see it's not even commanded by God. Does a person in that situation, even if their spouse is unfaithful, do they have the option of remaining married to that person and trying to deal with that and still be married? That's an option. It's not commanded even in that case, but that's the only time where God permits it. So if an elder's wife dies and he is remarrying, can he marry somebody who's been put away, that's been divorced by somebody else? No. So that would not meet the qualification of being the husband of one wife if he's in a marriage that the Lord calls adultery. So we understand by what the scriptures teach that would mean if he's married somebody else, if his wife has died, that he's married somebody else that he's qualified to be married to, and she's qualified to be married to him, and it has to be in the Lord. Another point about it, there are qualifications that a spouse has to meet. There are qualifications for deacons' wives, which certainly, when we look at the language in 1 Timothy chapter 3, 10 and 11, when he says, "Let these also first be proved," talking about deacons, these also have to be tested. In other words, there's a connection between that and what he's just talked about with elders who have to be tested, proved. And any qualification that a deacon has, an elder certainly has to at least meet that, but then they go much beyond. And it says in verse 11, "Even so must their wives be." Now, if this applies with that language, if it applies to deacons' wives, would it also apply to elders' wives? And the answer would be yes. But their wives, he says, must be grave, not slanderers, sober, faithful in all things. Now that would go for, that certainly applies to deacons' wives as it does for elders' wives. Well, if he marries again, does the wife that he marries, does she have to meet those qualifications? And yes, would be the answer to that. So there are different aspects to that situation. But if he has a spouse that has died, he marries again, and it's somebody that he is that God would recognize as being somebody who's eligible to be married. She's in the Lord. She's a faithful Christian. Meets these qualifications. In that case, would that elder still meet the qualification of being the husband of one wife? It would be difficult from the language here to say, well, no, that they are not. Now, again, there are some brethren that have the view that if they've ever been married again at all for any reason, at any point, that they don't think that's acceptable for an elder. Well, just using the language from the qualifications, it would be difficult to prove it to that extent, to say that is talking about the past as well as what their present circumstance is. Now, I hope that is helpful there. They have to be the husband of one wife, is what the qualification says, including all those different considerations that we just went through. All right, well, now we look at what comes after that. We're using as our basis 1 Timothy chapter 3 at the moment, looking through these qualifications, and we're tying in ones from Titus chapter 1 as we come to them, if they are touched upon in that passage as well. And then there'll be some that we don't see in 1 Timothy 3 that we'll get to in Titus 1, Lord willing. But we're starting with the ones in 1 Timothy 3. And the next one that we read about after he mentions the husband of one wife, that's in verse 2. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. The next one he says is vigilant. Now that particular word, the definition means to be sober and circumspect. What does circumspect mean? Circum always means a circle and around, and there are various ways in which that prefix is used in several English words that we have, but it means around, inspect, spectacles, or if you inspect something, that's a word that has to do with viewing, looking all around. So to be circumspect, looking all around, being sober, that is sound-minded. That's a word that we use sometimes to talk about somebody who's not intoxicated. Well, that would certainly be one form of not having your mind sound when you are using something, questioning the soundness of a certain mind here. But if we are using something that is causing our mind not to be able to be sound by chemicals or whatever else, well, that's not being sober. But being sober, being sound-minded, goes, of course, beyond just that. And an elder has to be vigilant. Now, we use that word, if somebody is vigilant, they're being very watchful. And that really is what it's about, being sound-minded and circumspect, looking around on the guard at all times, watching out for things. And we see that particularly from this spiritual standpoint. Well, that's something that he also includes in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 11 that we just read about, deacons' wives to be sober. That's the same word. And if he wants the elders, the deacons, and their wives to meet that qualification. So this has got to be something that for an elder, he has to be himself. His wife has to be watchful and sound-minded. And imagine that, though. I mean, what would happen if you had an elder in God's church whose wife was not vigilant also and sober-minded? Well, there's going to be lots of situations and information that's going to come to the elder as far as different ones. They're responsible for all the members of the flock. And if you have the spouse is not careful about things from a spiritual standpoint, also with the tongue and all of that, that can open up a door for a lot of damage to be done. And that happens sometimes. If tongues start wagging and people aren't on guard about things and protective of information, handling things in the right way, and looking out for situations to be very watchful and vigilant, then there can be big problems that result. So there's a reason why that qualification is given for the elder as well as for his wife. So he's got to be vigilant, somebody that's watching out, on guard at all times. Another place where this particular word is used is in Titus chapter 2 and verse 2. It translates it sober there also. And this has been given as a general qualification that all older Christian men should have. And so he says in verse 1 of Titus 2, "But speak thou the things which become sound doctrine, that the aged men be sober, grave, temperate, sound in faith and charity and patience." It's the first word there. Well, this is a characteristic that all Christian men, certainly if they're older in the faith, they need to have that as one of their qualities. And as we've said before, when we're looking at these things, these are things to learn from a Christian standpoint for all of us. We all need to be vigilant. That's something he tells us in 1 Peter 5, doesn't he? In verse 8, we need to be watchful because the devil is as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. He's after us, so we've got to be on guard at all times. When can we afford to not be watching? I mean, we just can't. We have to be looking all around, circumspect. We have to be like that always because the devil is after us constantly. Now, for an elder, thinking about what his responsibilities are for all the souls of the congregation, there we ought to be able to see why it's so important, because the devil's not just after him. The devil's after his family. The devil's also after all the sheep of that flock. They have the job of feeding the sheep and also of fighting off the wolves from devouring the flock. Now, how can you do those works if you're not vigilant? I mean, that we should understand is why that is a very necessary qualification for an elder in God's church, that they be sound-minded, that they be watching out on guard at all times. And this same word is translated, I mean, it's the verb form to be sober is used in a lot of other passages in Scripture, like 1 Peter 5:8, for example, and among several others. And when we look at all of that, we can see again that it's a general qualification that's important for all Christians, but we ought to be able to see how it's extremely important for an elder in God's church to have or to meet that qualification. Another one, 2 Timothy 4, verse 5. This is what Timothy was instructed to do as an evangelist. He says, "But watch thou in all things, endure afflictions, do the work of an evangelist, make full proof of thy ministry." Watch thou in all things. So there's a form of that word, being watchful, looking out. And we all need to be watching in all things. When can we ever let our guard down? I mean, we cannot. We have to always be looking out, expecting to be attacked by the devil and be ready for it, looking out for it when it comes. 1 Peter 1 and verse 13. He says, "Wherefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and hope to the end for the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, not fashioning yourselves according to the former lusts in your ignorance." Gird up the loins of your mind, be sober. That word sober, again, is the verb form of that word vigilant that we saw as a qualification there in 1 Timothy 3, verse 2. Well, here he's telling us concerning our mind to gird up the loins of our mind. Tighten that belt. That has language that we'll see also in Ephesians chapter 6 when he's talking about the armor that God has given to Christians. And the first one he says is having your loins girt about with truth, that belt of truth. But he's talking about it in terms of the armor. Well, we're out in a war here. We're in a battle, and we are facing the ultimate enemy, Satan, with all of his devices. And God is telling us we need to be prepared for battle, And we need to, and for a soldier, particularly in that time when he's describing their armor, how much of it was, and even today, I know Brother Tom, we have several with backgrounds like that. See, Andy, Ted, I know we got a few here that have had some military background and so forth, but and for those of us that hadn't, I know we've seen pictures and stuff, but I mean, there are all those belts and there's stuff hanging off of there. Lots of equipment and gear for the battle that's hung on that belt, but you got to have it strapped on and be ready to fight. And that's really the language that he's using there. And here he's talking about in our minds. So our minds have to be ready for battle. And we have to have that belt tightened and we have to have our equipment ready for the fight. And that means we've got to be on guard at all times. We can't be asleep. We've got to be watching. And so that's something that he wants all Christians to be doing. But an elder in God's church must be vigilant, is what he's teaching us there. Otherwise, they're not going to be able to do their job. And that should be plain to see. All right, the next one in 1 Timothy 3, verse 2, he says, of good behavior. That word is cosmios. It's kind of interesting because it's a form of the word cosmos, which is the word that's generally translated world in the New Testament out of Greek. And cosmos, when it's used to refer to the world, it means an orderly arrangement. There's only one place where that word is translated different than the word world in the New Testament, cosmos, 1 Peter 3, verse 3, when he talks about speaking to Christian women there in 1 Peter 3, verse 3, and says concerning the adorning, not being the outward adorning, but in verse 4, the hidden man of the heart. And that word adorning is cosmos, an orderly arrangement, which is translated world in every other place in the New Testament. Well, a form of that same word, cosmios, is the word that's translated of good behavior there in 1 Timothy 3, verse 2. And it means orderly. So it really has to do, and we think about the way the world is, and it should be pretty obvious why the Lord would use a word like that to describe his creation. It's not something that happened by a big bang. It's not something that just came into existence somehow. What is the new phrase that Stephen Hawking came up with recently? Spontaneous creation. Where it just, how can you, anyway, there is no such thing as that. There's no such thing as spontaneous creation. There is no big bang. Things did not just poof into existence out of nothing, which is exactly what that's saying. There is a creator, and there's orderly arrangement to this creation. There's design to it. I mean, look around. These things didn't just happen haphazardly. It didn't just come into being. And it's, I know it's kind of a side point here, but there have been some of these ones that teach that when they've been pressed on the point of, well, what, just try to put it in statistical terms of the probability. And some of you have taken statistics. I know that's enough to give you, make you feel ill right now. But trying to come up with the probability of an event like that, statistically speaking, how could you have from nothing to get all that we have here? With all of this this universe and all that's in it, life in all of its forms, us and everything. How could all of that just come to be like it is out of nothing to start with? And they'll come up with these, some have actually even tried to put it into mathematical terms. And the numbers, when you look at it, realistically, the probability means it's zero. Because it's, even by their own admission, it's so remote. It's essentially statistically equivalent to zero, which that doesn't take a mathematician to recognize that, does it? But then, and I remember my dad one time years ago when he was at a meeting up in Chicago, Illinois, and they had some of these leading scientists there, and one of them was saying, got up and said that the chances of all this happening, this is absolutely impossible that all this came out of nothing and a big bang and went through the whole bit, and said it's just impossible. And the amazing thing is, yet it still did. But that's that's the kind of blind faith that a lot of people have with no evidence. I know we've recently gone through that in some of our studies, some of our bulletin articles and things, but it just shows you the links that some people go to. There is orderly arrangement to this universe. There's no denying that. It didn't just happen. It was designed by our Creator. Well, as God was very orderly in the way that He went about creating all things, that this is a form of that word talking about what elders in God's church should be. They should be orderly. I mean, they can't be the kind of people that are what would be the opposite of orderly, disorderly. Well, think about the kinds of things an elder has to do in their work, and if they're not organized, if they're not able to handle things in an orderly manner, how are they going to be able to look after for all the souls in the congregation? I mean, that's just not going to work. You've got to have somebody that is demonstrating orderliness in the way that they're conducting themselves, and it has to, by their own behavior and the way they handle things. That's a very important aspect of their work. Now, it's a little bit difficult to get a handle on this word, trying to find it used in other places, because this is the only place. So really, to learn about it, we really have to look at the root of it, as we just did, as it's the root part of this word is means the world, the orderly arrangement of the creation. Well, here an elder has to be orderly in the way that he works. I should apologize. There's one other place that this word is used, and it is interesting. 1 Timothy 2 and verse 9 is the only other place that this word is used that is translated of good behavior, as in 1 Timothy 3 verse 2 for the elder's qualification. 1 Timothy chapter 2 verse 9, so it's just one chapter before, where it says, "In like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with braided hair of gold or pearls or costly array." Which one of those words do you think is that one that is translated of good behavior in chapter 3 verse 2? If you haven't looked it up, if you have, then you already know. It's the word translated modest there, in terms of a woman's a Christian woman's dress. It is to be orderly. Well, in the context, I mean, modest is not a bad translation at all, but there's got to be order to the selection of what she's wearing. It's not going to be something that is going to be revealing or provoking to others. So there's thought that goes into this, and there's orderliness to it. Well, for an elder, That is spoken of in a very broad or general respect there, as the qualification is given in 1 Timothy 3, verse 2. Not just in the way they dress themselves, but in all of their conduct. They're going to have to be very orderly. There's got to be thought to it, to where everything that they're doing. They've got to think about the ramifications of the consequences of whatever it is they're doing, and whatever choice they're making and the way they conduct themselves. It's not by accident, more than likely, that it comes right after vigilant. You're going to be watching out for all things, but then you've got to think about what you're doing and being very orderly about it, and thinking and about everything that is being done and about how that's going to come across. So that's something that we can see how that could have a big impact on an elder in their work if they're not being thoughtful about what they're doing and organizing themselves and taking thought for everything that they're going to do. That's going to be very difficult for an elder then to be able to effectively do the job that they have as shepherds over the sheep. Romans 12 verse 17 kind of goes along with it. Recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. That's a verse we read last week. Also, looking at the qualification of being blameless, we don't want to be able to be accused or being pointed out, seized upon as having done something wrong. So this fits in with that. You have to think about how things are going to come across to others. And again, you can see how that word would fit orderly for a Christian woman's choice of clothing. thinking about the way that's going to come across to others. And we need to think about the way others are going to perceive what we're doing. And so we have to be very orderly. And isn't this something that's sensible for all Christians to be doing? Again, it is. So we can learn a lot from these qualifications for all of us. Thinking about what we're doing and the way it's going to come across to others, and being very careful in the things that we choose to say and do, from our how we dress to everything. So that's something that is good for all Christians. It's a qualification for elders in the Lord's church. The next one in 1 Timothy 3, verse 2, he says, given to hospitality. I'm not giving the actual Greek word in all these, but this one's kind of interesting, at least to me. Philoxenos is the Greek word. Philos. We have Philadelphia, which you know what that means. The philos is fond of in Greek. Or sometimes translated love. It's not agape, which is the common word for love. It's more in the sense of having a affection for, fondness towards. Philadelphia, Delphos is the Greek word for brother. So Philadelphia means having brotherly affection or brotherly kindness, brotherly love. Well, here he says Philoxenos. Well, Xenos in Greek is for is a foreigner. So somebody who would be a guest, somebody who is not one of your own. So here it's talking about being having affection towards, showing kindness and love towards somebody that's not yours. So being hospitable. That makes sense. How is an elder going to do their work when they're responsible for all the souls of the congregation if they're not involved in the lives of all these people? I mean, that's part of the job. I mean, you have to be involved in the lives of all of the members of the church in that good sense. But to do that, you've got to be with them. You've got to spend time with them. And if you don't ever want anybody to come over to your house, how are you going to be able to do that? If you really don't like having people over, you don't like spending time with people, if you just want to stick to yourself and never be with anybody else, I mean, that's not going to translate into being able to serve as an elder in the Lord's church. So one of the qualifications is they've got to be, and it's literally, fond of guests. Well, that's something to think about. Do we like having company over? Is really a question. I mean, it's certainly, it brings its difficulties. I mean, there's a lot of cleaning up and a lot of work that has to go into that. That's part of an elder's work. If you want to go back and look at another practical reason why it's going to be a good idea, why God considered it a not just a good idea, but necessary for a man that's serving as an elder to be the husband of one wife, to have a spouse. I mean, there's going to be a lot of work that has to be done. Is he going to be able to do everything, or is he going to need his wife and her work to help out with some of these things? Well, they're going to have to entertain people. They're going to have guests over. And so it's going to be very important for an elder and his wife to be able to do that. Now, this word is also used in Titus chapter 1 and verse 8. This qualification is given in that passage also. So this is one of the ones that's given in both places. It's translated a lover of hospitality in Titus chapter 1 verse 8. It's the same word. Another place that we find it used, or the only other place we find it used in the New Testament, is 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 9. 1 Peter 4, 9. Use hospitality one to another without grudging. Another good reason to look at that is because he's not there talking about, he's not restricting that to elders in the Lord's church. Once again, for us to practice Christianity as it should be practiced, looking at passages like Hebrews chapter 3, 12 and 13, where he tells us to exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. Do we need to be involved with each other? Do we need to be in contact with each other, talking to each other, encouraging each other? He says, and do it daily. So we need to have daily involvement with people, with our fellow Christians. Is that going to require then that we're going to have people over to do that a lot of times? Yes. And so there he says, use hospitality one to another without grudging. And it's interesting he puts that. Is it easy to start grudging about having to do that? And he's anticipating that temptation to be griping about having to do all that work to have people over and things. But he says, this is something that needs to be done. We all need to be doing that. But it's absolutely necessary for an elder to do that. Otherwise, he's not going to be able to do his job in watching over the souls of the flock. We have several examples in Scripture of this being done. Let's look at Romans chapter 12 and verse 13. These are things that he's, again, instructing generally for Christians to be. He says, distributing to the necessity of saints, given to hospitality. This is something we should do. Hebrews 13 and verse 2 brings it home even further when he tells us to take care of those who are strangers. He says, be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unawares. And he's referring to some events that we can read about in the Old Testament. But one of the things he tells us to do is when we have others. And now, does this mean that we need to be foolish there and just whoever's out on the street just say, come in and move into my house? That's not what that's talking about. And that can bring all kinds of problems. We have to go back again to being watchful and being wise in the things that we choose to do, who we choose to keep company with. He's not telling us to be foolish and invite danger upon ourselves or put ourselves in a position where we can be reproached or bring reproach upon the Lord's church. He's talking here about entertaining some that we don't personally know. Now, in this context, would this particularly refer to brethren? Well, first and foremost, that's who we have responsibility for. Now, there may be others that we have an opportunity to help that aren't brethren, but that's where our first responsibility lies. We still have these kinds of opportunities, and I remember back in our years when we spent 10 years in mission work and we had to go and raise money in a lot of places to be able to do the work. We had to visit brethren in lots of different states and travel around, and it was kind of interesting to see. Sometimes it wasn't very interesting, but sometimes it was. But just to see how brethren in different places responded to those situations. There were some that would be very eager and just want you to come in and stay with them. There would be brethren in some congregations that were very eager to do that and try to make room for you, want you to come over, even though you weren't really known to them personally, but they wanted to take advantage of that opportunity to help somebody that was trying to do the Lord's work. Now, a lot of places, they would give maybe call or give you something to go stay at the local motel, which that was certainly, some people didn't do anything. that would certainly be a step above nothing. But we always appreciated it when the brethren would have us in their homes. And that was something that we were on the receiving end of that. But we got to look at it on the other side, too. We've got to do that ourselves and try to reach out to others that are in need like that. And we have lots of opportunities to take care of brethren at different times and in different ways, and we need to be willing to do that. But especially for an elder in their job, they need to be doing that regularly with the members of the congregation to be able to do their work. Saul referenced in Hebrews 13, verse 2, about some having entertained angels unawares when they were showing hospitality to strangers. Some of the situations that come to mind from the Old Testament where that was done, just for a note of reference, if you want to go back and look at that, Genesis 18, when Jehovah came, which by all appearances, no, it wasn't the Father, by all appearances, Christ was present with two angels that came to Abraham at his tent in the plains of Mamre. You think Abraham was grateful after that he didn't tell them just to get lost and go find some other place to try to get a meal or something? He was very hospitable in that case and took them in, fed them. And it's interesting to read about that account. And then the Lord was revealing to him what he was about to do to Sodom and Gomorrah, and where Lot, his nephew, was. Judges chapter 6, and an angel came to Gideon, and he fed him. Didn't know it was an angel, just like the Lord said there, just like Abraham didn't. When they appeared as men, how could you tell? I mean, when they appeared in a fleshly form just like we are, how would you know just by looking at them that was an angel? They couldn't tell. And we have examples of Abraham, Gideon, also in Judges 13 with Manoah and his wife, the parents-to-be of Samson. They did the same thing, and they showed hospitality to an angel then, not knowing it was an angel. So what he says there in Hebrews 13 and verse 2 is very true, and we have several examples from the Old Testament of that. But do you think they were glad if that was over, that they were given to hospitality? And, of course, there was a reason why the Lord chose to send his angels to those particular individuals anyway. But we need to be like that. We need to show hospitality. But it's an absolute requirement for an elder because of the level of involvement they have to have with the members of the congregation there. We're going to stop at that point. We still have one more in verse 9, apt or able to teach, which is central to an elder's work. We don't have time to, since we're about 3 minutes overtime anyway, we don't have time to go into all of that tonight. So that's where we'll pick up next time, Lord willing. Again, we appreciate everybody being here tonight and going through this, and really do hope that this is of benefit to everyone and trying to understand these qualifications better so we can look at ourselves and try to have these qualifications or these qualities as a Christian should have, but then particularly to understand them as it translates to an elder and the work that an elder must do in God's church, to understand that better. This is now an opportunity to, as we're going to be extending the Lord's invitation for anyone who needs to respond to come forward tonight, and if you're not a Christian, to come forward and be baptized into Christ for the remission of your sins as the Lord has commanded, or if you're a Christian who's gone astray, to come back to him, and having repented, then if you need the prayers of the church, you can also come. So if you need to respond to the Lord's invitation tonight, please come forward right now while we stand and sing.